This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Republican Mike Miller wants to flip Florida's 7th congressional district from blue to red. He's running against incumbent Stephanie Murphy, who's finishing up her first term as congresswoman. Miller says he's learned how to balance the budget and work across the aisles as a state representative. He now wants to take that approach to Washington, D.C. Miller joins us for a conversation about his priorities in this campaign, focusing on the economy, education and healthcare, and reducing the influence of the federal government. Well, Mike Miller is a Republican. He is the state representative for Central Florida's House District 47. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, really happy to be here, Matthew. Thank you.
What is it that made you want to run for Florida's Congressional District 7?
Yeah, thank you for, first of all, thank you for having me again. And then also, I think that's it's the perfect question to ask me because it's what I've been trying to do my whole life. And that is, you know, from the time I grew up and my parents told me to try to be a man for others, I've always done that. I moved here to Central Florida 25 years ago and, you know, got involved in Little League and started working on the Winter Park Housing Authority, started doing historic preservation stuff in the city of Winter Park. And I just always wanted to be a part of the community and give back. I had the great honor of being elected in the State House for the last two terms, and I really learned a lot in that. And that's what's driving me to run for Congress. I learned in the State House, I learned that we do it right in Florida. We balance our budget. We work with term limits. We work across the aisle because of that balanced budget amendment. It forces everybody to come to the table and make tough decisions because it's our constitutional obligation. And if you notice, most of the budgets in Florida get passed overwhelmingly, Republican and Democrat, because we work together to try to make that the best budget we can for the folks in Florida.
So having been in Tallahassee for a couple of terms, is that enough? I mean, do you feel like you've accomplished enough in your time there?
Well, I mean, listen, it is always a challenge to go through the maze of government. But I can tell you from my 4 years in the Florida House, one of the challenges we have in Florida is all of the federal mandates, all of the downward pressure from the federal government. It's the founding fathers. The states founded the federal government, not the other way around. And I think, you know, what I'm seeing now is that the federal government has taken over such an overwhelming role in everybody's life. And to run a state government effectively, you have a lot of pressure. I looked at the budget in Florida, and I would look at all of these things and say, where did they come from? Well, that's a federal mandate. We have to provide this. We have to provide that. Now, I'm not saying all of them are wrong, but it's a disproportionate amount of things that are downward pressure.
So what are some of the things that the federal government should not be exerting pressure on the state of Florida about?
I think one of them is education. I think, you know, we talk about this a lot. I know you talk about it a lot on your programs. You know, the federal government should not have a role in the state's education system. I think we have to be, and this is, again, back to competition amongst the states. We want to provide the best possible education for our students, K through 12 and all the way through the higher education system, because we subsidize that with taxpayer money. We want these kids to get a good education, especially if they stay here and go to a college, and we want them to stay here and work, and we want to be able to get that the reward of investing in these young men and women by having them stay and get good jobs in Florida. So I think that's really if you would call it almost a closed system, a circular system, that could benefit Florida, and we are doing it. We are actually doing very well, and the less we have the federal government telling us what to do and how to do it, I think it's better.
So are you saying that there isn't really a place for the Federal Department of Education?
I think in some role, the Federal Department of Education, I think, is there because, and sadly, it's what happens with government all over the world. Government has a tendency to grow. It becomes its own worst enemy. But in the Department of Education, I think there's still probably challenges. You know, we have with disabled children, with special needs, with unique populations. Those are probably roles that the federal government can help offset some of the challenges because it's very cost effective. I mean, very cost heavy and a bigger challenge. But it should be very limited. Should be very, very limited.
It does seem a little counterintuitive, though, Mike Miller, to say I believe in less government, so therefore I'm running for it.
Yeah, listen. As a member of Congress, you know, we are given a charge to go to Washington, and I'm so blessed to live in Florida, and I'm happy. I would like to stay in Florida. I would go up there and do my job and come home. But I do think, yes, I think the idea to go to Washington and government, like we talked about, it has a tendency to grow on its own. It has a tendency to keep, you know, we have all these agencies and they put out, I don't know if you look at the Federal Registry every day, but it's amazing how many things are put out by agencies which have the effect of law. And it's become this monster, if you will. So I think my role in going to government is to say, let's slow down. Let's slow down first, do no harm to the states. And then let's also look at this spending, because year over year spending with $20 trillion in debt, We have a looming crisis, and someday, somewhere, that there's going to be a call to action to say, okay, we have to start paying off this debt, especially if interest rates increase, and we have, you know, God forbid, we have another recession or another calamity where we have this giant debt hanging over our heads. That could be our kids, grandkids paying that off. It shouldn't be that way.
The national debt gone up since the most recent administration was elected, though?
It has been going up since World War II. I don't know when the last time we used to enact debt to try to get to save the planet with World War II, and now we've sort of gotten into this operation where we just keep spending. And I think what it really does start with the budget. In the state of Florida, we balance the budget, we make tough decisions, and the federal government, they start out in deficit spending, and it just keeps rolling every year, and that's sort of become the norm. That would be one of the things you talked about. You know, why go to D.C. and try to do less? That's a good idea. Less spending would be we would actually try to get our debt in order, and then you can't pay off $20 trillion overnight, clearly, but you got to get on a trajectory to get there, and it would start with trying to balance the budget this year, next year, the year after, and then take the excess. If we can give it back in a tax cut, great. But at the same time, let's try to pay down the debt.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to State Representative Mike Miller. He's running for Congress in House District 7. One of the other key issues is jobs, right? That's a big deal. And you can break that down several ways. You can look at, for example, wages and salaries. What would you be able to do as congressperson? What would you want to do if you're elected to Congress to help stimulate economic growth, help develop the kinds of jobs in Central Florida that people need and want?
Well, and that's one of the reasons I'm running for Congress, not in an open seat. I mean, Congresswoman Murphy is currently the representative in District 7, and we had a tax reform package that went through Congress, and she voted against the tax reform. And I will tell you with certitude, you look after that tax reform package happened, we have had 4% growth in our economy. We have record employment now, especially when you talk about record employment for minorities like Hispanics and African Americans. It's been fantastic. The lowest unemployment we've had since 1969. It's because of the federal tax reform that has going on.
That surely is not the only reason for it. I mean, some of these trends take a long time to develop.
I would argue that it's accelerated it significantly, and I would argue that that idea, what you talked about with jobs, is paramount to all of it. Government doesn't create jobs. We create the environment. We create the environment that allows a business owner or somebody who wants to start a business to invest in people. And what you're watching happen right now is because of the economic growth, people are hiring more employees. And then here's the thing about Central Florida that's really critical is we have a large service population. It's what we do. We bring tourists in. But now you can see what's happening. Disney has voluntarily gone ahead and said, we are going to raise the minimum wage to $15. It's because of the market forces. It's because we have said, you know, we are going to create a stable environment where you can invest in your workers. And Disney made the decision with the union input, and it was done with market forces.
Disney is one. It's a pretty big company.
Sure.
Granted, it's a huge company in Central Florida, big influence. So the fact that they are saying, yes, we're going to raise starting wages to $15 an hour
is
good.
Yeah.
But why not just have that across the board? Why not have a $15 minimum wage across the board?
Because my big fear in that would be rather than pay somebody $15 an hour, they would cut employees. You wouldn't be paying more people $15. You'd be paying less to $15.
Where they've actually enacted a minimum wage like that, though?
I can't speak to a specific example, but that would be the common sense thing where I, a business owner, I would say, shoot, I have to pay somebody $15 an hour. I'll just pay that one and not three people or whatever the terms would be at current market forces. And actually, the other piece to that, which is very important for your listeners and everybody understand, the minimum wage is really a starting wage. We call it a minimum wage, but it's a starting wage. And you would hope, and this is the other thing about what's happening in our marketplace today, is because we have pretty much full employment, if you want to keep a good employee, you better pay them more because he or she now has three or four job opportunities, whereas you were before having to go struggle to find a job. So that market force in and of itself will take that starting wage higher because I think that's a natural course. And then if you are in a starting wage job and you're getting frustrated with that pay, you go find another job. And there's hundreds of thousands of jobs in the United States right now that are going unfilled because there's not enough workers to fill them.
What about healthcare? What are your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, and what would you do as congressperson to ensure that people have access to good healthcare in Florida?
again, back to why I think it's a great experience to be in the Florida House. We worked on a bill, which I was a co-sponsor of, actually the prime co-sponsor of, to work on direct primary care. And I believe it's really important when we get back to what real healthcare is. It's actually a doctor and a patient knowing each other, working together, and trying to get to a place where we're doing preventative care rather than just getting sick or going to the hospital. Mm-hmm. We have lost that. And then we have this entire conversation going on about insurance and all. Really, what needs to happen is we need to do what the bill I passed is, which creates a doctor-patient relationship, a contract, if you will, not going through insurance, to provide, it can be means tested, to provide real authentic healthcare. And then if they find out, you know, God forbid, that they have cancer or something like that, we should have a catastrophic healthcare system, not a healthcare system that covers, that covers everything. It should be okay. If you can afford insurance, you should be able to pay it in the private marketplace. If you have a catastrophic situation, that's what insurance should be used for. And then we also have a piece of the puzzle that's being underutilized in our country, and that's health savings accounts. I think that's a very powerful way to put money aside, non-taxed to help with those, which should be a preventive maintenance situation. If we got into that situation, I think the entire cost of healthcare would go down. And that's really what we need to talk about. We need to talk about true cost in healthcare and then trying to get to a place where we have a preventive maintenance system instead of a sick care system.
Right. But if you don't have health insurance, then you aren't going to get things treated that you should, and then you can end up in a crisis, right? I mean, that's what happens.
Well, I think, if a doctor is able to go and advertise that, you know, for whatever the fee is that you can afford, we can have a relationship and we can start working on some of your ailments or some of your long-term situations. That is what we need to get to. Right now, everybody's trying to swim around and grab insurance, and we've seen what's happened in the private marketplace. Insurance has gone up, and we're trying to offset it with federal monies to pay for, you know, the Obamacare mandates. It's become a system that has too many strings to it. It really needs to be centralized down to the doctor-patient relationship, to health savings accounts, and to catastrophic insurance.
Would you say then, if you centralize it, could it be a government-run health system?
I would be terrified of a government-run health system, because I think that would get us into a whole nother situation of cost management from a federal government side, which would clearly lead to more health care, less quality. And God forbid, we'd end up having situations where people couldn't get access to healthcare because it would just take too long. We'd have lines. We'd have socialized medicine, which I just cannot see in this day and age working in a population like the United States. It just wouldn't work.
Is it just because it's the United States? Because it does work in other countries.
I would argue that. I would argue it works in other countries. And I would say while our healthcare system right now is not working at maximum efficiency, if you let market forces start to work in the healthcare system and you start to let doctors get back to what they truly do, and that is provide medical care and not have to figure out how to get reimbursements and how to get all these things that are in the back of the house, I think you'd see – one of the most important things we need to do is we need to inspire our doctors to want to be in healthcare. We want to get our best and brightest not to go to Wall Street necessarily, but to go to medical school. And that's one of the fears I have is we still have the greatest healthcare system in the country and
in the world.
But we have challenges, and that's one of the great things about the conversations we have in government and the conversations we have in public. And that is, how do we make it better? And my idea would be to focus on the doctor-patient relationship.
I want to ask about national security, because that is something that, as a member of Congress, you would be thinking about. What is your solution for border security, immigration, other aspects of security?
You know, I think one of the best remedies for national security is a strong economy. Because when you have a strong economy, you can afford to pay for a strong military. And when you have a strong economy, you're able to help countries that maybe have, you know, we have a crisis on the southern border right now because of the calamities in El Salvador and Honduras with unstable governments. And I don't blame somebody who's in a terrifying situation, and maybe their husband was taken away or murdered, or what God forbid what happened, you know, is something that's caused them to leave their home, walk 1,000 miles to the United States border and try to find asylum. A strong economy in the United States makes a stronger economy for the world, and I think that would help some of these places in the world that are going through a lot of economic strife.
Okay, final question then. I want to ask about gun safety, because, of course, Central Florida was, until fairly recently, tragically the site of the worst mass shooting in recent U.S. history until Las Vegas. What would your strategy be then to look at that issue and try and bring about some change there?
Well, You know, I went to the dedication of the memorial there at the Pulse site, and I was very proud of Earl Crittenden, the chairman of the board there, and he called it what it was. He called it a terrorist act, and it really was. You know, he had pledged allegiance to ISIS on the phone there, or whoever he was talking to, police, and then obviously did this horrific tragedy. So there is a challenge with that. That's a terrorist act. And then we also, because I was in the legislature during the Parkland shooting, went through that experience. And that, what a catastrophic failure that was to let that young man get to the point where he was going to take some beautiful children's lives and the workers at the school. So that particular case in Parkland, and that's something that I would look at on a national level, is we have to start talking about the mental health situation where young men are at that point where they think they could do harm to others. And we have to make sure that in the mental health world that there is safeguards in place, that somebody who is mentally ill has no way to get access to a firearm, to a weapon. I would work on that on the federal level for sure. That the mental health situation, especially with young men that are willing to do this, it seems to be young majority of the time. But and I think we have to have a large conversations, which we are having right now. We're having this conversation about mental illness and how do we handle it. We've got this terrible opioid addiction going on in our culture right now. We worked on some legislation in the state house to do that. I would work on that in the federal level too.
So it's not about access to firearms?
It's about access to firearms for somebody who is mentally ill. We need to absolutely make sure that we already have a lot of laws in place on background checks. We already have a lot of laws in place on what kind of guns you can and cannot own.
Do you think those laws are working?
We need to enforce them. We need to enforce them.
Mm-hmm. How would you go about making sure that happens as a member of Congress?
I would encourage the state and local authorities to look at what's on the books and use what's there. Use what's there. And then if we have a conversation in the future where those are inadequate, I would listen. But right now we have lots of laws on the books that I think we need to enforce.
Mike Miller, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, this was great, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
Up next on Intersection.
I'm somebody whose life is a reflection of an opportunity at the American dream. I'm a refugee, an immigrant, the first Vietnamese-American woman ever elected to Congress.
Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy joins us for a look back at her first term and what she hopes to achieve if she wins re-election. We're back in a minute.